I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Listening to political pundits talk about President Obama's problem with white voters, you might be surprised to learn that more white middle-class and working-class voters supported him than they did Bill Clinton, Al Gore, and John Kerry. That's what our guest Joan Walsh writes in her new book, What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. She describes how her own Irish Catholic family benefited from government programs and policies aimed at the middle class. She joins us to talk about what's happened to the middle class since that time, race relation, party politics, and this year's presidential election. Joan Walsh is a columnist for Salon, where she's also editor-at-large, and she's a political analyst for MSNBC. And Joan Walsh, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks for having me back, Marty.
I wasn't sure how to say the title of your book, whether it's ironic, is it angry, is it frustrated, is it sad? What do you mean by the title?
All those things
is
and
it?
More. I've been saying that it's really got three meanings in a way, but one of the meanings has gotten the most attention thanks to Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan and the Republican Party, and that's the kind of head shaking. What's the matter with white people, and why are 9 out of 10 Republican voters, according to Gallup polls, white? And that's in a country that's 62% non-Hispanic white. That's one of the problems that I'm looking at in the book, because I think that once racial change gets politicized and politics gets racialized, it really makes it harder for us to be the country we've always tried to be, which is, the country that believes in e pluribus unum, out of many one, and the country that when you think about American exceptionalism, it means different things to different people. But I think to most of us, it means that we've really been able to make one strong, the strongest in the world, country out of very many people who fight and don't get along in other places, and that's been our strength. And I think in the last few years, people are beginning to wonder if that's no longer true. So that's certainly one of the meanings of the title.
Well, you also write about your own life, as you say, growing up in an Irish Catholic family that benefited from many of the programs directed to the middle class that came after World War II. How was your family helped?
Well, my Irish grandparents came from Cork on the eve of the Great Depression. They had 6 kids in the course of the Great Depression. They were desperately poor. My grandmother cleaned houses, and my father, she made a little raisin wine, and my grandfather did whatever he could. His first job here was building the Empire State Building, which was a job that went to a lot of Irish men at the time. But then after that, it was hard to find work. But they were helped by a whole array of programs that we put in place, especially after the Great Depression, and especially after World War II, where we really made a decision that we were afraid of income inequality because it led to instability. It led to depressions. It led to wars. And so government together, we the people, I guess you would say, made a series of decisions to make it easier to join the middle class. In the New Deal, we made it easier to join and form labor unions, which was a huge boon in building that middle class. We had Social Security and other kinds of income protection, so people weren't completely alone taking care of their older relatives. We had the GI Bill, which helped, certainly my uncles take care, come out of the war and buy homes and go to college. We did a lot of things. It was easier to go to college for everybody. We were building public universities at an enormous clip. We were building roads out to the suburbs, and we were electrifying rural areas. It really was a story of government together with American people. I mean, I'm not saying my grandparents and parents didn't work hard. They worked like dogs, but they had the wind of government at their back. And I think, again, what's the matter with white people? One of the things that may sometimes be the matter is that many white people don't think of all of that superstructure of opportunity as government help. They really and truly believe that they did it on their own.
Well, just picking up on that, you write, our failure to understand how government built the middle class creates two big political problems for us. First, too many white people think they didn't have help, that they did everything on their own. Then predictably, they reject the idea that they got something African Americans and Latinos didn't get. It makes a kind of sense. If I believe I didn't get help, how can you say you didn't get something? I don't even know what I got. We have to talk about that. The idea, focusing on white people, because because in many ways that's what your book is about, but recognizing how government has helped white people over the last half a century.
Well, yes, and also recognizing that, you know, this golden age that we talk about really was golden for some of us. That, you know, I really think it was my childhood that I'm talking about in mm-hmm. the 60s a lot, but it left a lot of people out, and it wasn't so golden for African Americans and Latinos who were left out of all of those programs I described, going back to the New Deal. You know, FDR, great hero of mine and of all Democrats, nonetheless, to get the New Deal passed, he had to leave African Americans out of many of the programs that he first passed in order to mollify Southern Democrats. And that continued with the GI Bill. The NAACP demanded that there be non-discrimination language in all aspects of the GI Bill and didn't get it. The suburbs that we moved to sometimes had restrictive covenants so that African Americans couldn't follow us out there. And then banks redlined and wouldn't loan in those neighborhoods that white families left behind for the suburbs, so that those neighborhoods crumbled and black families either couldn't buy homes or couldn't improve or keep up the homes that they had bought. And so it's really tragic, because not only were black and Latino people left out of this, but white people don't even fully acknowledge the extent to which this was help that they got, a kind of affirmative action for white people. And so you have this situation to this day where we often seem like we're talking past each other.
You also write, and I thought this was interesting, that you were inspired to write your book after reading Charles Murray's book, his book titled Coming Apart, The State of White America, 1960 to 2010. What was it that he wrote in a sense inspired you to write your book?
Well, this is another one of the meanings of the title, right? What's the matter with white people? And this is the conservative version of this, and I would say it's, what's the matter with white people? Why are they so shiftless and lazy all of a sudden? Because Charles Murray, as I'm sure you know, became infamous in the 80s. He really provided the intellectual foundation for Ronald Reagan's famous saying, "We fought a war on poverty, and poverty won." Charles Murray's book, it was called Losing Ground, it came out, I think, in 84, basically laid out a lot of statistics that scholars later refuted, but it didn't matter, that purported to show that poverty was rising, and in particular, black poverty was rising, because black people had decided they didn't need to get married, and they didn't need to work very hard, in fact, because they could rely on welfare, and that welfare had caused the rise of black poverty in the 70s and 60s, 70s, and particularly the 80s. No matter how many wonderful scholars refuted his data, that notion took hold, that we can blame black poverty on welfare, not on racism, not on an economy that wasn't creating enough jobs, etc. Well, fast forward to 2010, and I'm sitting here reviewing this book, Coming Apart, that he wrote last year, which was a bestseller, and Charles Murray is saying the exact same things about the white working class, what he calls the white lower class, that the people that are falling out of the middle class and into poverty, or into sort of a desperate level of the working class. And this is happening, Marty, not because our economy has changed, not because of the 2008 crash, not because we've shoveled all this wealth to the top 1%. No, it's because they are lazy, they are not getting married, they are not working hard, and they are relying on the government dole, even though we've slashed welfare ridiculously since he wrote his book Losing Ground. So, you know, I had this moment where I'm used to kind of the liberal critique of white people as, you know, voting against their interests and supporting the Republicans and maybe being a little bit too racist for good. But now you have conservatives asking, what's the matter with white people? And honestly, this is really what's behind Mitt Romney's comments about the 47% of people who just won't take responsibility for their own lives.
And I want to pick up on that, but I found it interesting that you do criticize the left for their, as you say, their scorn for the white working class. That's a broad statement there. But nonetheless, many things have been said about the white working class by progressive, by liberals, that probably isn't true.
Well, I became particularly aware of this and frustrated by it during the 2008 primaries when I went into the primary season. I'm just going to admit my bad judgment up front. I was a John Edwards supporter. So I got to watch some of the sniping between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama supporters for a while from the sidelines. And when Edwards dropped out, I really wasn't sure who I was going to support. But as I looked at at least from the sidelines for a while at the two campaigns, you know, I was struck by the extent to which Hillary Clinton had a slightly more progressive platform on domestic issues. Her vote for Iraq almost certainly doomed her presidency. But on domestic issues, she had come out for a foreclosure moratorium, and Obama had not. Her health care plan was more inclusive than his. She had voted for credit card interest limits. There were three or four issues where he was a little bit closer to the banks than she was, even though she was the senator from Wall Street. She had her own, you know, friendship with Wall Street as well. And I also saw that she was getting the votes of white working class men and women, particularly women, but also men. But immediately the analysis of why she was doing that wasn't about her campaign pitch. It was exclusively derided as racism. And I wound up getting myself into a lot of debates about that because I thought that there were two terrific candidates, and I thought that there were lots of reasons to support both of them. But I thought that the knee-jerk analysis of her white support as being only about people being unwilling to vote for a black man was incredibly unfair to many people who were not supporting her for that reason. And it kind of brought back old tensions between a kind of do-gooder elite that scorns the white working class while trying to advance African Americans and to some extent Latinos, maybe mainly African Americans, and the white working class, which feels like that do-gooder elite has nothing to offer it and therefore rebels and, you know, gets into backlashes against whatever that do-gooder consensus wants. And I saw that in the Clinton-Obama battle, and I didn't think enough people knew the history that preceded it.
And we're almost up at a break here, but do you still see that I guess, perhaps divide among Democrats or even progressives on this white working middle class?
I would say it's much less pronounced. You know, I was just actually to write a story. I was just trying to go back to some stories that I saw in late 2010 and early 2011, saying that from Democrats saying that President Obama was just going to have to write off Ohio. He could not win Ohio because of that awful white working class. And now, of course, he's I think 9 points ahead in Ohio. So there was a time when the bitterness of 2008 resurfaced, and the scapegoating of the white working class was even louder. And I took issue with it at the time. It really informed a lot of the book. But I think that's changed a lot for reasons we can talk about later in this hour.
After this very short break, and that's Joan Wall. She is editor-at-large at Salon, also a columnist at Salon. You probably see her, or you can see her, on MSNBC, where she's a political analyst, and she's also the author of a new book we're talking about called What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. We're going to take a short break, get back to our conversation, also open up the line at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, This Is the Week That Is, the election special. Written and performed by Philadelphia's own Jennifer Childs and the This Is the Week That Is ensemble, 1812's annual political satire features a script that changes with the headlines and up-to-the-minute reporting on all the news that's fit to skewer. Tickets available at 215-592-9560 or at 1812productions.org.
I'm Mike and Scott. Listener support is vital to WHYY, and we'll be asking for yours during our upcoming membership campaign. But the October buyback is your chance to help give us a head start. Make a pledge during our October buyback, and for every 750 donations we receive, you'll buy back one day. This means one less day of pledge and one more day of news without membership breaks. Do your part at whyy.org/support. Thank you.
Conquer Cancer supports WHYY and announces the Pillowcase Pajama Party, Friday, September 28th, 6 to 9 p.m. at the Please Touch Museum. Children can explore the museum, share story time with Chica and the Pajanimals, march in the PJ Parade, and more. Presented by Teva Pharmaceuticals in partnership with the Philadelphia Eagles. The event supports children with cancer and other life-changing illnesses. For tickets, conquercancer.org. That's conquercancer.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Joan Walsh, author of a new book called What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. There's a new survey from the Public Religion Research Institute, which dovetails pretty perfectly with your book, talking about some of the myths about the white working class. Myth number one, white working-class Americans strongly identify with the Tea Party movement. Not so true. Myth number two, white working-class Americans have abandoned traditional religiosity and a strong work ethic. Not so true. Myth number three, white working-class Americans vote against their own economic interests. It seems that we make a lot of generalizations about the white working class.
We do, and I was really thrilled to see that study because it really bore out a lot of things that I argue in the book with my own statistics as well.
Yes.
As my own instincts.
Yes.
But it was striking, Marty, because it basically showed you that if you take out the South, and that's a tough thing to do, but if you take out the South, Barack Obama is quite competitive with Mitt Romney, with the white working class, and in fact, going back to Ohio, where we left each other at the break, he's winning the white working class all over the Midwest, which I think probably has something to do with the auto restructuring, but lots of other things. You know, I think that we have just assumed that the white working class became Republican in the 60s and 70s for reasons that I write about, and that they're irretrievably lost to us. When, you know, in my research, I saw that every year they went a little bit back to the Democratic Party, and you know, Bill Clinton did win them his second term. He did better than Obama his second term, but Obama did better, as we said before, than Al Gore or John Kerry, these white Democrats. So I felt like people's stereotypes and presumptions about the, quote, racism of the white working class were blinding them to opportunities, and also to regional differences, to cultural differences, to age differences. You know, the problem, that study and what I saw in my research, the problem is really older, white working class Protestant males. I mean, President Obama is doing competitively with women, with white women, younger white working class voters, Catholics, surprisingly to some people. So it's really a group that he's quite competitive with, which is why Mitt Romney is right now in a world of pain.
But I do want to pick up on that 47% speech that Romney made back in the fall that's created quite a kerfuffle for his candidacy. But looking at as you described, the white, older white male Protestants, is this a group that generally speaking then leans more conservative, or has a kind of tie to the past, or to the good old days?
Even with that group, I think, you know, we can look at it, we can and should look at it with an element of compassion and empathy, because they are the group for whom things have gotten toughest. You know, their wages have declined, their employment has declined. There's now all this talk about maybe cutting back Social Security and Medicare. They are the group that's the most pessimistic about the future, and they don't think that their children are going to do better than they did, and they may well be right. That doesn't seem like it's mere paranoia. And so I think there are reasons for them to sort of give up on government, and they wind up very sensitive to appeals that say, let's just get government out of the way because they've never helped you, forgetting all that help that they got 30 or 40 years ago. There's also, of course, racism in there. You know, I think that it's impossible to really untie race and class and attitudes towards the government, especially in the South. I don't want to say the South is the only racist region, but the history there, you know, when Southern Democrats left the Democratic Party and became Republicans, it was largely, if not exclusively, around race. And so, you know, there may be an element of that older white male Protestant Southern demographic that we're never going to get back. And, you know, probably shouldn't spend a lot of time arguing with, but I find that, you know, that is when I feel that so many people, when they picture a white working class person, they picture the face of that older Southern, you know, resentful guy, rather than, you know, a younger white working class kid or a Catholic woman, and it really blinds us to an opportunity to pull them into a multiracial social justice coalition.
Well, picking up on Romney's comment said to donors at a $50,000 a plate dinner, this was in Florida back in May, and Mother Jones picked up on this, and of course this is now dogging the Romney campaign, but his 47% comment, how much do you think that reveals about how Romney really thinks about the electorate?
I think it reveals a tremendous amount. I mean, we have all been saying, Democrats, Republicans alike, who is the real Romney? And, you know, Ann Romney told us, if only we could see him unzipped. Well, you know, we've seen him unzipped now, and it's not pretty. And I have to say, you know, I would never vote for the man, but I didn't assume that he held so many people in such contempt. The tone of his voice and that specific thing that he said, that I can't make people take responsibility and care for their lives, as though half the country is not taking responsibility and doesn't care about their lives and just expects to be taken care of by government. I wouldn't have said that Mitt Romney felt that way, honestly, if you'd asked me before hearing that. There's a very contemptuous, arrogant, elitist tone to his voice and to his words that I think is really resonating, and not in a good way, with a lot of people, including a lot of Republican voters. I mean, we had Republican pundits come out and attack him immediately, but for some of them, honestly, it was really just, how could he say that out loud? But for other people, I think it's genuinely, how can he think this way? But sadly, this is what has happened in the last 10 years to this Republican Party. That's a mainstream point of view on the right. That was the point of Charles Murray's book, Coming Apart, that more and more Americans, Paul Ryan calls it the divide between the makers and the takers. And so they really do believe that all of us, white, black, Latino, Asian, we're old, young, most of us are takers, and that we really want to be reliant on government, and we really don't want to work hard. And, you know, the white working class has heard those sorts of things about minorities, and believes that those words are usually used about other people, not them. But, you know, they've become the new welfare queens in the Republican Party in the last few years.
There's always been a level of suspicion about government, but can you trace it back to Reagan when he talked about government being the problem, that the level of suspicion about government and even criticism about government today seems to have grown over the last couple of decades?
Although there are some, you know, there are some polls this year that show that things are getting people are getting a tiny bit more pro-government. The attitudes toward government are more positive right now than they've been since early in the Obama administration. I can't explain why that is. So it comes and goes. But I would take you back before Ronald Reagan, Marty. I would say that what happened in the 60s really turned a lot of people against government. And this is something that I try to do in my book that I feel that a lot of liberals don't really do. And that is, look at the events of the 60s not merely as a kind of unbroken march of freedom and liberation, which for a lot of us it was, but also look at what might have been scary and what did go wrong in those years. You know, the civil rights movement was the greatest movement of my lifetime. You know, that and abolition, I think would have to be the two most important movements in our history. Feminism is part of why we're sitting here today. You know, these are great movements, and we were right to, you know, those of us who worked to stop the war, I was kind of young, but hope I would have. We were right about that too. But at the same time, a lot of those movements, the fringes of those movements, said and did a lot of things that scared people. And even, you know, I in the course of the book, I realized that in August of 1965, Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act, gave a speech saying, "We shall overcome." And about a week later, the neighborhood of Watts in Los Angeles went up in flames. It was over police brutality. It was over racism and discrimination and violence and mistreatment. But that was the beginning of a Republican backlash, because the reaction to Watts was, oh, well, you know, Democrats are giving those people all their rights, and they're giving them welfare, and they're giving them help, and this is what they do, you know. And so there was a perception that we went too, you know, that we were doing too much too soon rather than, you know, too little too late, in my opinion. But there was an association between these things that Democrats did for minorities and the poor, and women, as a matter of fact, that somehow were blamed for creating the riots, the rise in crime, the rise in divorce rates, some erosion of the family. And so Republicans were really good at saying, hey, Democrats were in charge, blame them, the problem was government activism, the problem was government interfering in everybody's lives and undoing the social order that really was pretty great for most of us. And a lot of white working class, including people in my family, were very, very receptive to that appeal, because they were genuinely afraid.
And that's Joan Walsh. She is editor-at-large, columnist at Salon, author of a new book called What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY, covering a lot of territory, and we want to get your calls in. Joan, let me get some calls in. We have Dave from, looks like, Havertown. And Dave, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you. I'm enjoying the discussion.
Thanks.
I grew up in central Pennsylvania, and, you know, traditionally Republican area, very much a hotbed there, very hardworking, blue-collar, Christian area. And, you know, it dawned on me, I mean, as you know, I was very much, you know, Republican background and so on, but I've evolved. And I think the thing that, in hearing your guest talk, is how, you know, in looking... In my growing up, and my parents and so on, and their work ethic, basically, I feel what the GOP has been able to do is leverage their work ethic and then leverage this fear that Democrats represent handouts, and the GOP is there fighting for this hardworking person. I personally now think it's complete bunk. they've done a nice job of it. And I remember President Clinton at one point said that he feels like his party has done a bad job at welcoming, like, Christians, so to speak, you know. I think it's all kind of lumped together. And I was wondering what the guest thinks, or if there's something along those lines.
Now, Dave, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Joan Walsh, go ahead.
Dave, I think you're absolutely right, and I think that President Clinton, you know, did try to talk to those voters and to talk about the people who, you know, the people who work hard and play by the rules. That became a Clinton, you know, one of those Clinton slogans that was trying to signal. It wasn't racial, because he was speaking to black people and Latino people who work hard and play by the rules too, but he was really trying to talk to those voters who felt that they were doing all the right things, but they weren't necessarily getting ahead. You know, and of course that was the big, you know, that was the big trauma in 2008 when Barack Obama made his remarks about people who are bitter and cling to their guns and religion, which, you know, certainly hurt him. Now, I argued at the time, and I argued last week during the flap over the Mitt's 47% comments, if you read Barack Obama's entire, you know, 5-minute discussion about those left-out Pennsylvania voters, there was a lot to agree with. He wasn't holding them in contempt. What he was really trying to do was get his San Francisco elite audience to understand that they weren't only not voting for Obama because he was black. Kind of the point that I was making before. Obama was always better than a lot of his supporters on these racial issues. But to say, look, they've been left behind by the economy, they've also been left behind by the government, and they have good reason to be bitter and to distrust government and to distrust Democrats. So I think that that's going to be a long, you know, a long battle for Democrats, but that they have a unique opportunity, as, you know, folks like your relatives hopefully, you know, maybe understand that, you know, that 47% includes some of them. You know, a quarter of that group is seniors who are now relying on Social Security and Medicare. So, you know, the other problem, though, people have said to me, and it's partly true, a lot of people who are in that 47% don't know that they're in it. So, you know, we all hold a lot of misconceptions about our own economic status that kind of can interfere with perceiving things politically.
Dave, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But Joan, it seems that especially when times are tough and people are scared, it's easy to tap into that fear and even that resentment. And it seems the Republicans do a very good job of that.
They do. They always have, you know. But I guess, I mean, especially since we're talking about Pennsylvania and you're in Pennsylvania, what I saw, you know, what I wrote about a surprising amount in the book. It's not that long. I don't want to scare away people who aren't that interested in
I read it
books
yesterday.
About history.
Yes.
But there, you know, there's a chapter about Irish American history and Irish Catholic history and Irish Black history, and specifically in Pennsylvania, you know, there were incredible Protestant Catholic battles and particularly, you know, attacks on Irish Catholics who what I discovered in writing the book was that, you know, there were portions of the country and periods of time in which leaving out slavery, big thing to leave out, but you know, in the non-slave states where, you know, Irish Catholics vied with black people to be the lowest of the low and were for, you know, missionaries of the time and for evangelists and even to some abolitionists, frankly, were really below black people. Were really considered dumber, dirtier, lazier, drunken, promiscuous. You know, all those things that sadly became black stereotypes in the 60s among some white people. Those were Irish stereotypes. Mm. We were the animals. But I think that some of the animosity comes in that there was this kind of, again, elite New England do-gooder crusade that really scorned and sometimes even oppressed those working-class Irish Catholics on behalf of the cleaner, harder-working Protestant black people. And you saw that in the Pennsylvania primary. You really did. You see it. I think you see it in certain states like Pennsylvania to this day.
Well, and it's interesting, you're talking about class, which is something that rarely ever gets talked about. We can talk about race, we can talk about partisan political divides, but class is a tougher thing to talk about.
It is. It is much tougher for lots of different reasons.
Well, in part because we pretend like we don't have class in this country.
Well, the myth and reality of egalitarianism and of social mobility, I think we really pride ourselves on being a classless society that you can climb from the bottom to the top in a generation or two. And as long as that was slightly true, it was never totally true.
Right.
There's always, you know, it's always been very hard to climb, especially from the bottom. But as long as there was some social mobility, I think people were okay with that being a story that we told ourselves. And maybe that story even helped some of us just not look at the obstacles in our way, but we've become an extremely stratified society in the last 20 to 30 years. Old Europe, you know, Europe, the continent of classes and snobbery, has way more social mobility from class to class, generation to generation, than we do. That's appalling.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation, talking with Joan Walsh today on Radio Times, author of a new book called What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. She's a columnist and editor-at-large at Salon, and she does a political analysis for MSNBC. A couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Einstein Medical Center Montgomery supports WHYY. Opening late September in East Norriton, Einstein Medical Center Montgomery offers quiet, all-private rooms designed for patients' comfort and safety. Other features include a 24-hour emergency department staffed by board-certified physicians, cardiothoracic surgery, cancer care, orthopedic care, robotic and bariatric surgery, and a maternity unit equipped with a Level 3 neonatal intensive care unit. More information at 1-800-EINSTEIN or einsteinmontgomery.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Early voting is underway in many states. How is it changing the way candidates campaign? Also, we'll meet June Foray, the voice behind Rocky the Flying Squirrel and Cindy Lou Who. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Speaker Series, presented by Widener University, offers a season of diverse ideas, world perspectives, and thought-provoking conversation. Featuring Erskine Bowles of the Simpson-Bowles Commission, former president of Mexico Vicente Fox, Miracle in the Andes survivor Nando Parrado, plus a special guest speaker you won't want to miss. Information on the complete lineup of speakers at PhiladelphiaSpeakerSeries.org. Sponsored by WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Motz-Cohen talking with Joan Walsh. She grew up in an Irish Catholic family, as she writes about in her book. She's editor-at-large and columnist at Salon, where she writes about politics. In fact, family and politics form the backbone of her new book called What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me see what Anthony from Kensington has to say. Anthony, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you? You're on the air. Go ahead, Anthony.
Yeah, thanks. Another kind of personal story. I grew up in a working-class neighborhood and a working-class family in Providence, Rhode Island that was mainly Italian, Irish, Jewish. And it's not just Providence, it's the entire state of Rhode Island. The black population is minuscule, but at the same time, the racism there against black people was, well, very, very strong. And so a hatred against people who were not present, right? And I had a very difficult time figuring out how that was. It wasn't about things about, like, you know, about competition for jobs or competition for housing, the way that historians explain this in the 20th century. A hatred against people who were not there. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, Rhode Island has remained a very solidly democratic state, right? It's not a swing state. It votes, the state's political offices are almost all, occupied by Democrats, and it's always a sure state for the Democrats in the presidential campaigns. And so, there's kind of contradiction there that I, you know, as an historian now who studies labor in the working class, that I've been trying to figure out for quite some time. And I wonder if Joan Walsh has any idea about how to explain this.
Well, I think it's a very interesting way that you put it, Anthony. And Joan, I'd be curious about your thoughts.
Well, I think that it might be. I mean, Anthony, I feel presumptuous telling you what it might be since you lived there, but since you asked, I'll try. I mean, what it might be is that, yes, it was a kind of visceral and psychological reaction, and it was ugly, but on the other hand, because they weren't competing for jobs and schools, their schools weren't being integrated, et cetera, then the Republican politics of resentment that these people are taking your jobs and your schools didn't really work. It didn't play out in their communities. Unlike, say, Macomb County, Michigan, which was a suburb of Detroit, which was literally the home of Reagan Democrats, because it went 66% for JFK in 1960 and then 66% for Ronald Reagan in 1980. Wow. And so it became the epicenter of that phenomenon. But one of the things that had happened was that they were subject to forced busing from Detroit. They'd moved out of Detroit, you know, to get away from the schools and perhaps African Americans. And then, you know, that issue followed them. And so maybe where the politics of race and the specific resource questions around race aren't that aren't divisive, people were able to stay Democrats even if they harbored their own racial views.
Interesting. Anthony, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Jeff from Wynwood has to say. Jeff, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah. I think that, like, in terms of the older white voters, I think a lot of what is driving it is difficult to determine, in the sense that it's, not to sound too Marxist, but it's very much overdetermined, by which I mean a whole lot of factors I think go into it. So, for instance, you know, we have, you know, the country and technology is changing so rapidly. We've got, you know, massive social fragmentation. The economy moves, you know, very, very quickly. And people and the society itself is, you know, changing. And I think for these older white people, it's very threatening because it threatens their, and they think this is, this goes also back to the title of the book, which I'd like to read, this longing for something that never was, longing for a kind of stopping the world, because what these people see and they find so threatening is all this change and all this, you know, the country is becoming not white. What? That scares the crap out of them. Then you have gays. They want to get married. That disrupts their whole vision of how, you know, the very structure of the society.
Well, Jeff, you made a really good point, and I want to give Joan Walsh a chance to respond. Joan, your thoughts?
I think some of it's definitely race. I don't think all of it's race, because I think when we can look at all these changes, some of which, you know, not to sound Marxist, but some of which are the result of capitalism and an economy that just doesn't work in ways that any of us understand anymore. And it's given so much power to the movement of money and the privileging of the financial sector and all those things, and families not looking like they did, and maybe life for children, for many children, not being what it was and what we would like it to be. And so, I think nostalgia is a very powerful thing. I think that, I sort of advise trying to treat these people with at least some compassion and empathy, and not assume that it's all because of race. But I think that we have an opportunity to create a vision of this country that is, you know, mm-hmm. multiracial and successful and inclusive and includes white people and includes white seniors, you know. And I just have to say, another poll, Mitt Romney went from having a 20-point lead over President Obama with over 60 voters to having only a 4-point lead this week. Don't know exactly what it is, but again, you know, President Obama is competitive with groups that you know, Al Gore and John Kerry wrote off, and that he wrote off, or his people wrote off a couple years ago. So something is changing that's allowing us to, I think, to have more of a conversation with some of these people and to talk about what they're afraid of and say that, yeah, well, we're afraid of some of the same things. Let's get together on this.
Jeff, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But do you think, Joan, that that's coming from the kind of campaign that Mitt Romney is running, that has forced some of these people to rethink their position on issues, or even rethink how they think about the president?
Well, I think it's forced them to rethink how they think about Romney, for one thing. Certainly, it's more what Romney is doing than Obama is doing. But on the other hand, I think it's some of what Obama is doing as well. I mean, concretely, you know, the auto restructuring certainly helped him. You know, that was a vote for the working class, and it certainly helped him in the Midwest. I think that his rhetoric has been much more inclusive and much more specific. You know, one of my issues with President Obama in 2008 was that he had this ethereal appeal to hope and change and bipartisanship and post-partisanship, and I felt that it probably wasn't really getting through to working-class voters who had very concrete concerns about how they were going to put their kids through college and why were their jobs going away and why were their wages dropping. And I feel like in the last 2 years, the president's rhetoric, his jobs bill, his language around the economy has become much more both populist but also more specific in a way that, you know, Mitt Romney is not matching him with specifics, and when he gives you specifics, 20 minutes later, somebody from his campaign says, oh, he didn't mean that. So, you know, I think that between his contempt for the 47% and his inability to tell the truth about what he would really do to improve this economy and make people's lives better, he's completely blowing the election and giving the president a chance to make inroads with many, many more groups of voters than we thought even 6 months ago.
What do you make of the fact that Bill Clinton now seems to be back in the fold? And certainly I think his speech at the Democratic National Convention really was a rallying point for a lot of Democrats. I won't say a rehabilitation of Clinton, but what do you make of the fact that he now seems to be the real standard bearer for his party?
You know, I think that was a bitter primary in 2008. But even in 2008, I mean, it was funny, Marty. I was in Charlotte, and I went back for like 2 days. The big Beltway scandal was, oh, Bill Clinton hasn't submitted his speech for the Obama team to vet it, and they're worried, and he might undermine him. And I went back to Salon in 2008, and I read that I had written the very same story about the Denver convention. Same exact hoopla. And in 2008, there's probably more reason for it. His wife had just lost. There was a lot of bitterness. The president was called a racist. He was angry. But, you know, with the exception of some of his personal decisions over the years, the president is a grown-up. The former president is a grown-up. And he also, you know, Barack Obama winning secures his legacy. And I think that Obama has done some very smart things in terms of cultivating Bill Clinton. And I think that they have reached an understanding. I don't know that they golf together or that they would, you know, call each other up on a Sunday morning to hang out. But I think that they understand the world better. And I think Barack Obama woke up to the notion that Bill Clinton did not bring all that hatred on himself. That there was a right wing conspiracy. It wasn't very vast then. It's vast now, and that they have the same enemies, and that they've learned to talk the same language of economic opportunity, and how good Democrats are for the economy. And so they're a team now.
Well, I'm quoting from your book, Joan. You write, people can argue that Clinton sold the party, sold to corporate America and Wall Street. I've thought that way myself. He gave an enormous gift to the banking industry with a repeal of Depression-era Glass-Steagall regulations. And I guess in this nostalgia, we have to, you know, truly remember past presidents and what they did or didn't do.
We do, and we have to. I think another thing that we have to remember about why the white working class was suspicious of Democrats is that Democrats did move away from their legacy of protecting the little guy. Democrats became the party of Wall Street. Bill Clinton had a lot to do with that. Glass-Steagall had a lot to do with that. Barack Obama was the Goldman Sachs candidate, and you know there are lots of people who think that that's why he went easier on the banks than some people in his government and outside of his government wished that he did in 2009 and 2010. And of course, he didn't go easy enough. They hate him because they're so used to, you know, being the masters of the universe. But, you know, the Democrats did move in some ways away from their traditional base, not by, you know, favoring minorities and women, but by favoring big business and Wall Street. So I think that we have to reckon with how Democrats abandoned their old base in that way, too.
Let me get Ann from Collegeville to join our conversation. Ann, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
This goes back to an earlier part of your conversation when you were talking about how people don't understand how government has helped them. And you have the classic, you know, keep your government hands off my Medicare. But my favorite quote is the Craig T. Nelson quote when he was on Glenn Beck. And he was talking how we have a capitalist society and he was poor. And the actual quote, I think, is, I was on welfare and food stamps, and did anybody help me? No.
I think that is the quote, Anne, actually. I've seen that. Joan, I'm sure you've seen that as well.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, there's so many misconceptions. There's the idea that welfare and food stamps isn't help. I think we also have to reckon with the fact that there are some people receiving... The New York Times did a great piece about this a couple months ago, that, like, they're talking to Tea Party leaders who were on welfare. But, you know, to be intellectually fair to them, some of them know that they're on welfare and they're pissed about it and they don't want to be on welfare. And they blame government for, you know, not creating jobs or not letting capitalists create jobs or whatever it is. There's a lot of complications in terms of how people perceive, and some of them, I think, wrongly blame President Obama for the situation that led them to be relying on food stamps rather than thanking President Obama for expanding food stamp eligibility during a recession so that they can feed their children. That might be my impulse, but that isn't everybody's.
And thanks for the call to Radio Times. Just even looking at the last couple of days of the election, and you see some of these events with Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney, and there does seem to be, Joan, more enthusiasm for Paul Ryan, at least at these events, than for Mitt Romney. How do you understand these running mates?
Well, I think Paul Ryan looks like a man who really regrets his choice. And, you know, we have never elected a losing vice president in history except one time, and it was FDR. Mm-hmm. Losing vice presidents go off to pasture somewhere. And so it really may be that Paul Ryan has completely given up any chance of having a national career with this move. Having said that, yeah, there's more enthusiasm for Paul Ryan among the Tea Party base, he is a true believer. He's an extremist. He's with Todd Akin around the issue of, quote, legitimate rape. He says he doesn't want any exceptions to the abortion ban, not even for rape. He says rape is just another form of conception. Conservatives are saying, let Paul Ryan be Paul Ryan, and I'm saying, oh, I would love that too. Please send him to Florida and have him talk about turning Medicare into a voucher program and talk about his ideas for privatizing Social Security. He's a hard right ideologue whose ideas I don't think would be any more popular with the country if they knew them, but at least the Tea Party would be happier. And if Mitt Romney loses, you know, I would hope that moderate Republicans would say, hey, we let these people take us too far to the right, but honestly, I think the Tea Party people are just going to go nuts and say, you know, you muzzled Paul Ryan, you forced Mitt Romney on us, and the problem was we didn't go far right enough. So it's going to be a very interesting battle if they lose.
But we need a strong two, maybe three-party system to be a really functioning democracy, it seems to me.
Well, yeah. I mean, a three-party system is tough because of the way we, you know, the way we vote and,
right,
and the way we don't apportion representation,
right,
in Congress to other parties. So, you know, I'm not sure that's going to happen anytime soon. But we do need two strong parties. And, I mean, I have a pitch in my book to even to Republicans who, you know, if you really see what your party is doing and if you're appalled by it, especially, you know, I wrote the book before the 47% remark, you know, why not try voting for Obama this time as just a protest vote? Because it's in your interest, as well as in the interest of the country, that the Republican Party come back to its senses, that it become the party of smaller government, not government that is so small that it fits in our uterus, that it become the party of fairness for everybody, not the party that scapegoats minorities. You know, in California,
well, you
I
know what,
saw
Joan, we have to, unfortunately, we have to end our discussion. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times, playing my song. And her book, you're welcome. And the book is called What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. And she is a columnist for Salon. Bob Alls, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, a show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.